welcome to Pod Rights. This is a series of podcasts from the Australian Human Rights Commission. I'm Graham Innes, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner. Most of us go into public buildings regularly as part of our daily activity, whether it's work, sport, recreation, community activities, etc. And we don't even think about the ramp at the entrance, the width of the doorways and the corridors, or the braille or large print on the lift buttons. But for some of us, it's pretty important because it makes the difference between whether we can use those buildings in a safe and dignified manner or whether we can't. 12 months ago, standards or regulations were added to the Disability Discrimination Act to improve this access. And on this Pod Rights, we'll talk about these standards, who they benefit, and how they affect our buildings. With me to have the conversation is Michael Small. Michael runs a small business, that's not a pun intended, working with people with disabilities, business, government and the building sector to assist in making buildings and services more accessible. Michael has worked with people with disability in England and in Australia since 1975. And from 1993 to 2011, Michael worked at the Australian Human Rights Commission, developing guidelines and standards to improve access to public transport, access to the internet, access to education, access to local government services, to banking, and to the built environment. So he's a real expert in this field. And he's on the phone from Hobart today. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Graham. It's lovely to speak to you. It's quite amazing. It only seems like yesterday that we celebrated on May the 1st, 2011, the introduction of the premises standards, along with members of the drafting committee and representatives from the disability sector. So it's lovely to speak to you today.
Yeah, well, it doesn't seem very long, does it? But 12 months ago, so some listeners, Michael, may not be aware of the standards, despite your efforts travelling all around Australia in conjunction with a number of others to educate people about the access to premises standards. So what do the standards cover and how do they make buildings more accessible for people with disability?
Yeah, well, let's just go back a little bit and just sort of recap on what the objectives were when the premises standards were first being discussed well over 10 years ago now. There were three real objectives. One was to actually create what we might call systemic change, change across society to the way in which buildings are designed and constructed. Mm-hmm. People with disability had access to discrimination laws for many decades, but those laws were somewhat limited in the amount of change that they could create across society.
Yep.
So we had a really strong objective to actually create that systemic change to buildings.
Mm.
And the other two objectives were really about creating consistency in the way in which access was provided in buildings, and also to give surety to the building professionals and the developers in Australia that if they built something according to a set of specifications and standards, that they knew that they were actually fulfilling their responsibilities under law. So we had those three objectives very much in mind when we started the discussion. In terms of what the standards do now then, well, basically they apply to all new buildings and those parts of existing buildings which are actually undergoing upgrade or refurbishment,
right,
and where there's an involvement of a requirement for a building application.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very definite trigger for the sorts of buildings that are covered. And how are they going to make buildings more accessible? Well, I think it's probably best to imagine that there are two baskets associated with what the premises standards are achieving. The first is to set out some new requirements that have never been seen before in building laws in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And examples of that would be a requirement for access to public swimming pools, specially designed toilet cubicles for people who can walk but find it difficult to use standard toilets, passing spaces on long, thin corridors, and access to some of the common areas of buildings such as apartment blocks and blocks of flats.
Yeah.
So they're the sorts of they're examples of the new requirements that have come in with the premises standards.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a much larger block of access requirements, which basically improves existing or long-standing access requirements that we've had for many, many years in building laws. And examples of that would be things like the widths of doors, so that people can pass through them, the numbers of accessible toilets in buildings, improvements to signage to assist people to find accessible facilities, and improvements for those people who can use stairs into the way in which stairs are designed to ensure the greatest safety possible. So overall, I think the premises standards, as they progress and as they become implemented, will progressively improve opportunities for people with disability to participate in and contribute to our communities, which is obviously a critical part of achieving equity and dignity for people with disabilities in our world.
Sure. Now, one of the problems in this area before the standards took effect, Michael, was that there were two parts of the law that applied to buildings. The first was the Australian Building Code, and the second was the Disability Discrimination Act in terms of access to premises and people being able to discriminate. So how do these standards address that problem and fit under both the Building Code of Australia and the Disability Discrimination Act?
Yeah, well, as you describe, people responsible for buildings and people wanting to use buildings had to reference two quite different laws. The Building Code, which has been around for many decades, had requirements within it which provided a certain level of access, but it's always been the case that discrimination law, in particular the Disability Discrimination Act, had requirements which could mean that somebody could meet the building law requirements, but would still be subject to a potential complaint. So as you said, there were inconsistencies between those two laws. What the premises standards does is that it essentially tells designers and developers and those people who are responsible for certifying buildings what they must do now as a minimum to actually meet their responsibilities under Disability Discrimination Act in relation to the design and construction of buildings. The design and construction specifications in the premises standards essentially replace the general non-discrimination requirements of the Disability Discrimination Act. I might add that existing buildings that are just sitting there and not undergoing any new work will continue to be liable to complaint under the general DDA complaints provisions.
Yep.
So under the premises standards, if somebody complies with it, they can be confident and be sure that they cannot be subject to a successful complaint of discrimination in relation to those areas that the standards cover. So if they build a building according to the standards, and which tells you that a door has to be a certain width, and they do it to that certain width, then they can't be actually subject to a successful complaint in the future. So the premises standards replaces those general, non-specific provisions under the General Disability Discrimination Act.
Okay.
Most of the requirements of the premises standards are found in a section which is called the Access Code to the Buildings, the Access Code for Buildings. And there have been changes that came in at the same time as the premises standards to the Building Code of Australia that reflect the content of the Access Code for Buildings. And what this means, of course, is that in the vast majority of access issues, we've now achieved a consistency between the DDA and Australian building law, which was one of the main objectives that we set ourselves back in 2001 when we first started this project.
Yep. Now, these standards, Michael, aren't just for people who use wheelchairs or have mobility disabilities, are they? Do they assist people with various types of disability?
Look, I think it would be fair to say that most of the improvements affect people with mobility disabilities, including, obviously, people who find it difficult to walk or move around, or people who use wheelchairs. But yeah, there are many parts of the premises standards that improve access to buildings for blind people and people with low vision, people with a hearing impairment, and people with learning disability or cognitive disability. I have to say that although there are a range of access provisions which affect a range of people with disability, I think there's a need for some more work to be done in the future to catch up on some of those other issues that people with different disabilities experience when they try to use a building. And I think that's a work for the future.
Sure, sure. Can you give us some examples of how access is improved by the standards?
This is a very significant change in law, and there are many, many areas where there have been improvements. But
sure.
Let me just give you a few examples.
Sure.
Under the old building law, there was only a requirement for the principal entrance to a building to be accessible. You could have a building with 3, 4, 5, 6 entrances. But under the old law, only one of them was required to be accessible.
Mm-hmm.
These new requirements say, under the premises standards and the new building code, that including the principal entrance, at least 50% of entrances have to be accessible, which is a significant change from the previous requirements. There's better signage for toilets and for directions to accessible facilities. So, for example, if under that 50% rule on the building entrances, one entrance isn't required to be accessible, there's a requirement that good signage is provided to direct people to where the closest accessible entrance is.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier the introduction of requirements for turning spaces and passing spaces, which has never been in building law before, where you've got a long, thin, narrow passageway. Obviously, if you're using a wheelchair and get stuck going down that passageway and you can't get anywhere at the end, or the office is locked at the end, backing up 20, 30, 40 metres is obviously a very significant demand on people.
Yep.
So there's a requirement for certain provisions for turning and passing spaces. And just a final example, there's a very significant increase in the numbers of unisex accessible toilets that are required in a building. I'm sure you understand this, Graham, but try and imagine the consequence of the lack of accessible toilets if you're a person who uses a wheelchair going out into the community.
Yeah.
Many people with disabilities spend as much time planning their routes and planning their activities around whether or not they're going to be able to get access to a toilet. And I think that's been a very significant impost on the lives of people with disability. And these very significant increases in the requirements for accessible toilets is going to have a very important knock-on effect for people's ability to go out and enjoy the community and everything that it offers.
Yeah, very important changes. Now, Michael, you know, I know that changes such as this can have an impact on more than just people with disability, and I mean, many things have done that in our society. I mean, from the Alexander Graham Bell's invention of the telephone, which was originally a means of people with a hearing impairment communicating, through to things like audible traffic signals, where lots of pedestrians who don't have a vision impairment take advantage of them, and the list goes on. So what will be the impact of these improvements? They don't only benefit people with disability, do they?
No, absolutely not. You know, I mean, perhaps I could put that question into two parts. And the first one is the effect that it will actually have on people with disability. I think it's important to understand that accessible buildings are really a critical part of a matrix of things that need to be in place to ensure that people with disability have equality and are able to enjoy the dignity of full citizenship.
Yep.
If you don't have adequate personal support to get up and get out in the morning, if the buses and the trains aren't accessible, if the school doesn't open its door to you, if the local cafe or workplace or post office isn't accessible, you can't possibly participate in our community as equals. So while the premises standards are only part of that matrix, they're critical for people with disability wanting to work or to enjoy a play or a cinema, to visit their child's school or to socialise with friends or to go shopping. And you and I both remember, I think it was Bill Shorten, when he was Parliamentary Secretary for Disability, once said that the experience of people with disability was akin to apartheid, and that the most important civil rights issue yet to be addressed was access and equity for people with disability. And obviously what we're hoping with the premises standard is over time it will change public buildings, workplaces, schools and universities and shops so that people with disability can enjoy those things in exactly the same way as those people who don't have a disability take for granted nowadays. The benefits for other people are very tangible as well, I think. Obviously, the premises standard is going to benefit people who currently have a disability. But I think it's really important that we all remember that that actually means all of us. At some time in our lives, we, our sons or daughters or neighbours or work colleagues, will all temporarily or permanently lose our ability to move around or see or hear at the level that we do now. So these changes are an investment in all of our futures. So it's not really adequate or appropriate to just look at them as changes that affect people with disability. But to pick up on your other idea about the effect of the broader community, I think I'd just like to give maybe two or three examples of where these improved access provisions will have an effect upon all of us in the community. The first one perhaps is there's a requirement under the premises standards, and has been for many years under building law, that there are very high, what's called luminance contrast nosings on stairs. There's those strips that you see at the end of the nosing of stairs. Now, they're critical for people with low vision, people who are blind but have some vision, because they assist a person to very safely negotiate stairs, because it means that you can see the edge of the stair tread, and that's really important for judging where you are. But just think, I know from my personal experience that if I'm in a hurry, if I'm talking on the phone or if I'm carrying bags, whilst my mind might not be conscious of those nosings and the colour contrasting on it, my brain certainly registers them. And they're a really important safety feature for people who don't have a disability but are using those sorts of facilities. Another example just occurred to me yesterday when I was actually at a hospital for an appointment. And this is about signage. Clear, consistent, high-contrast signage isn't only vital for people with a learning or a cognitive disability or people who may be confused or people with low vision. It benefits all of us. I was sitting outside an office in the reception area of the hospital for about 30 minutes, and during that time, at least four people who didn't obviously have a disability sought out instructions from staff because the signage was inadequate or confusing. It was there, but it was haphazard, it was different fonts, different colours and different styles, and it totally failed as a wayfinding device. And when you're in hospital and a bit nervous and a bit lost, the provision of good, clear, high-contrast signage, which is principally, in the first instance, an aid to people with disability, actually helps all of us. And if I may just divert a little bit, not to the premises standard, but to the public transport standard, as a final example, I got the bus home from the hospital yesterday, and I was sitting there, it was an accessible bus, and I was sitting there just reflecting on the accessible features of this bus. And it dawned on me that over the past year or so, or several years since accessible buses have been introduced, that you constantly see the spaces, the wheelchair accessible spaces in buses, if they're not being used by a person in a wheelchair, constantly see them being used by other people. The look of relief on the face of an older person with a personal shopping wheelie trolley, or a backpacker with a large pack, or a family with a young child in a pram, you see them constantly getting onto buses and rushing to those spaces because they know that that is a great space for them to be. And so very quickly, those features which are traditionally or are seen initially as being provisions for people with disability become part of good customer service and
yeah.
convenience.
Yeah.
In this instance, the example was on a bus. So I think as we look around us, there are a never-ending number of examples of where the accessibility, the safety, the convenience, the dignity, which is embedded within the premises standards, actually has a knock-on effect and a benefit for all of us in community.
Yeah, three really good examples, and I mean, you haven't mentioned there the ramps and their benefit for people using prams and for couriers with trolleys or for people with wheelie bags, moving them around in the community, and the list just goes on and on, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you. I think it's really important to recognise those benefits, those broader benefits for the community, and also the fact that that anyone in our community can either very quickly and easily incur a disability or have a family member who is in that situation. So these standards aren't just for a few people who use wheelchairs, they're for all of us.
Yeah, it's an investment for all of us.
It
absolutely.
Is, yeah. And thanks to all of you listening to PodRights. Remember, this podcast is for you, so if you have a suggestion of someone with whom I should talk or a comment on the podcast, please email me at podrights@humanrights.gov.au or find me and message me on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Graeme Innes, GraeMeInnes. Also, if you want to engage more on human rights issues, have a look at tellmesomethingidontknow.gov.au or our Something in Common project, where you can read fascinating human rights facts and stories, participate in polls, add your own content, and find out what you can do to advance human rights issues in Australia. And keep your podcatchers ready for the next PodRights in the series, because human rights are for everyone, everywhere, every day. I'm Graeme Innes. Goodbye for now.